This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
The Dungeon as Slasher.
Jan Marsalek.
1991 Fantasy Film Essentials.
And Medbeds.
Well, I sure am glad President Cat greenlit the Catstronauts' mission to expand the International Space Station. I hear he signed the authorization by swatting a pen across the floor. True leadership right there.
Giant laser pointers in space? What's not to like? And even better, the space station has live stream cameras. Although, half the time it's just nose boops. Let's check how the Catstronauts are doing up there on the space station.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Here comes the kitty technician, Blanket. Careful, Waffles. If he catches you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, then it's back to litter box duty for you.
Wait a second, Robin. Major Meowser just got a hair-raising transmission from HQ. Is that the new napping module on its way?
Yep, it's their first space station edition. Science Officer Pom Pom better know what to do, or there'll be a... catastrophe in 3, 2, 1.
Here she is, and she's sharpening her claws on the instruction manual. Well, it might accidentally flip to the right page with enough swiping, I guess.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady with his prodigious belly. Blanket is swatting at the module's fasteners like a feather toy. Pom Pom finally found the right instructions, and Major Meowser is, napping on them? Teamwork, by golly!
Hooray for the Catstronauts!
The space station is saved!
Until the next module arrives and starts another near-catastrophe, that is.
Wow, managing your own space station with a crew of feline heroes. Now that's the life!
You know you can, Robin! The official Catstronauts board game is available now from Atlas Games. It's full of pawsome color art by the comic book's creator, Drew Brockington, and Catstronauts features cooperative play that's fun for all ages. Find out more at atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Sounds like the Catstronauts board game is perfect for the whole family. Let's meet this stellar challenge by picking up the Catstronauts board game now!
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton come... Oh, no, that's not Peter Frampton. That's Michael Myers.
Ah!
And not the funny Canadian one, the mean one who stabs babysitters and such. Somehow, he's infiltrated the gaming hut. He's behind us. Was that thump actually his booted foot thumping on the floor? Was that crunch the crunch of someone's glasses being struck off their face? Oh, no. That was, in fact, just a clatter of dice. All we did here at the gaming hut was summon up the specter of Michael Myers, as well as all of your other favorite slashers, because we are going to be talking about the structural similarities between a good old-fashioned high-mortality OSR F20 game, the funnel, if you will, the dungeon funnel, and is it the same as the slasher in the slasher flick? Does it follow the same rules? And, well, I mean, I don't want to get into does the virgin live, because depending on your D&D table, that could be a very unsatisfying game. But what other roles of the killer are we thinking of in the structural sense?
And I think, first of all, the focus on deliberately doing a funnel game is about 95% an indication of OSR as not a absolute revival movement, but as a neo movement.
Right.
Because I think back in the day, no one consciously thought of a high mortality rate dungeon or called it a funnel as a good thing that you were setting out to do. It wasn't something that you would talk about as part of the core of the experience. You accepted that first level D&D characters, even second level in some cases, I'm looking at you, you spindly little sorcerers and wizards, that there was an acceptance of the fact, well, of course, it makes sense that you would have very weak characters and they would go into the dungeon and some of them would be killed by rats. or spiders, not even giant spiders, but just sort of regular spiders. That was something that you accepted as part of the experience and did have a function in the game, in that the characters who survived, you felt they, you know, had survivor's vigor. They'd been through the ringer and made it through, and that maybe said something about that version of the character that you roll up all the time. That's back when rolls were random, so, you know, you were losing something if your strength 100 guy got bitten to death by a rat. But I don't think in the beginning people were thinking about this as part of the deal. And so this, first of all, points to the way that OSR is thinking about the old school experience in a way that was not being thought about at the time, and that thinking about it is a neo part of the experience. So I don't think the original play style, even in games that took pride in their high mortality rates, were thinking about this in the same way that we're thinking about it now, and that it wouldn't have been appropriate to make the comparison to a slasher then, because you weren't setting out to create that. You were just using the rules you were given in a way that made sense to you.
Right.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. I mean, I assume that given the number of people that played D&D back in the day, there were some people who actually did delight in designing killer dungeons. But for the purposes of this discussion, I think we can certainly say that the funnel as a concept is part of the neo OSR, or the neo old school movement. And
it's the neo NAS of the OSR.
Yes. Right. And so the notion of the funnel, I guess we should mention, is that the dungeon and the encounters are deliberately designed to winnow the players down, that it's not just
We're usually lax about this, but I think this time we need to specify the difference.
Yeah, between, we should say winnow the characters down.
Winnow the characters.
Right. I mean, some of them also winnow the players down, and they say, I don't want to play this, and they leave.
Yeah, some of them will winnow off to a story game after getting their strength 18 fighter killed by rats. That'll winnow too, but that's outside the bounds of the discussion.
Yes, but the goal is not to simply trust to a grinding random monster encounter table and a blasé disregard for levels to do your job for you. It's to actually design a series of encounters that are targeted possibly at the characters, possibly at a generic party of characters, such that there is an encounter that is designed to drain all the spell slots from the wizard, and there is an encounter that is designed to eat away at the hit points of the paladin, and there is an encounter that is designed to cause so much damage that the cleric's healing becomes exhausted, such that it does become a sort of last man standing survival horror type experience. And whether that then, as a survival horror game, it then equates to the slasher, I guess, is how much intentionality do the players feel that the player characters are suffering under, if you follow me, right? If it's simply adversarial, we hate the DM, I'm not sure that's the same thing as, oh, this is a gauntlet that we have to pass through, and whoever emerges at the other side is the final girl or the final gnome or whatever, right?
Right. And your mention of the final girl brings us to the how slashers typically work, which is there is a moral dimension to who gets killed. Sometimes the killer just gets the dumb people, and that makes sense. And that is absolutely people who make characters who make mistakes in the dungeon are the equivalent of the foolish guy who, you know, goes out into the woods when he's been told not to, in search of the beers that he's hidden in the extra cooler. And so somebody, you know, walking into a trap and getting sliced, I think that's an equivalent scene. But there tends to be in the slasher flick a idea that the person who makes it is the person who has proved themselves in some way to be deserving of making it. And making it also includes killing the slasher, right? Killing the who's essentially the boss monster as well.
Right.
And the boss monster wipes everybody out. And then the last character standing is the one who takes them out. So I think that the moral dimension of who gets to survive in a slasher film, the equivalent of that in a OSR game is, you know, the most rugged character, the one that most deserves to survive. By surviving, they've proven themselves fittest. It's a less of a moral dimension than a, you know, being subjected to evolutionary pressure.
The Darwinian dimension.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, whatever combination of die rolls in rolling up your random character at the beginning and in surviving the traps and so forth, the characters who survive the funnel are proven superior. And I think that, although structurally it doesn't resemble a slasher flick at all, that if you're running a funnel game where everybody gets a bunch of characters and the winnowing is deciding which one of your PCs lives long enough to go up a level and become more robust, that there's a bit of that moral dimension in there, but that the analogy, although it sounds fun, kind of doesn't quite track. And it might even be that a war movie is perhaps a better analogy, in that you accept in the typical war film that the person who survives is very often, well, A, the handsome leading character, but generally people get wiped out along the way, and that's just the thick of war, as it were. And so,
In a war film, it flips the moral calculus on its head, because the people killed along the way in a war film, by and large, are either the innocents, he was just 18, he just come from Brooklyn, or they're the people who were bad. They were kind of jerks at the beginning, but under the, pressures of war, they have learned sacrifice and nobility, and then they're killed. And so it's almost that the message of a war film, as with the message of, say, all World War I poetry, is that the war kills the best of us. And the survivors are merely, they may still be handsome leading men and a little scuffed up, but they are definitionally only tough. They are only Darwinian survivors, and they have been brutalized by and large by the experience of that war film, and that they've been made worse by the experience, not refined in any way by it. And so I feel like the war film is a better model for what the dungeon might feel like on the ground to the player characters. But as against that, you do always have the notion of intentionality, that a GM is doing this to you. And so therefore, the single opponent factor of the slasher, maybe the dungeon funnel is like a Saw movie or one of those movies.
It's where, not war is hell, it's Steve is hell.
Right, yeah. And so you are being tormented by a prankster god of Saw or even the Freddy movies, such that in theory, Freddy obviously could just be killing you whenever he wants to, but he's waiting for it to be a good, gory, exciting, fun kill. Freddy is a really good dungeon master because he wants all the encounters to be memorable and thrilling. And in that way, I think you can maybe move a little bit more towards the structure of the slasher, because we do have a human opponent, as you say, it's Steve. Steve is hell. And we also have this sort of intentionality to the encounters, unless Steve is just literally built a 10x10 grid and filled them with an increasingly large number of monsters that he got, by going alphabetically from the monster manual. That is, undesigned. But then that becomes like the cube, I guess, is if we're doing strained horror metaphors.
Yes, the cube, I guess, is pretty much already a dungeon full of traps, right? It's a series of rooms. So if you want to take this metaphor and turn it into a premise for a game, perhaps your Halloween F20 one shot, you might, make that more evident. You could have the entrance to the dungeon could be by Crystal Lake. And you might even literally, instead of orcs, you could have different knife-wielding undead avatars of murder summoned from around the multiverse. That could be a fun thing. But also just you could, by telling the players that it's a horror survival dungeon, that you should be expecting descriptions of super gory kills, and that should be a part of the fun of it. And you should expect, the person who survives at the end and kills the boss slasher might be the person who gets a round of applause at the table. Or you could do more of a war movie thing. And it's like, nobody's coming out alive, but who's the one who, managed to get all the way through to sacrifice himself along with the rest of the party in order to save the world from the dungeon by Crystal Lake.
I mean, you can also present it as sort of a Running Man or Long Walk type situation where the mean king has thrown you guys into the labyrinth, and whoever gets out the other side gets freedom, and whoever doesn't is eaten by the Minotaur and the Ankh Egg and the giant rats and everything else. Or you could present it as a living dungeon, a la 13th Age, where the dungeon itself is the slasher, and instead of rolling around looking like a piece of a castle, it looks like a small Midwestern town when it shows up. And then you go in and discover that all those little houses conceal scary murder basements, and the scary murder basements are all connected. And sure enough, there's these knife wielding shades that are coming after you, and you have a proper, you know, literal haunted dungeon in the sense that yep. the dungeon is alive and aware that it is full of ghosts, and it wants to be, and it wants to terrify you, because that's how it gets its living dungeon mana, is by fear and not simply by your blood sputtering into the flagstones. That's nice, but it lacks a certain flavor, a certain zhuzh, if you will.
Right. And so you can literally have a demonic force like Freddy mm-hmm. showing up to mock them and to confront them with encounters that reflect their psyches. Or you could have an automaton puppet show up to deliver the instructions and the mocking directions. And you could even, for once, puzzles could have a purpose. You could, you know, the first one to solve this puzzle gets a pass and gets to survive the next fiendish trap. So that could be, speaking of OSR, speaking of going back to the original, you could make what is normally one of the most irritating things about F20 gaming, make it irritating for a reason.
Yes.
That part of the deal.
It stays irritating, but it's also scary now.
Exactly. Well, now that we've presented a way for you to irritate your players, which is always really our goal in this, yep, it's time to escape this killer dungeon and see what other structure or hut awaits us on the other side of this beautiful handcrafted commercial. ...1968.
Sinister influences threaten to corrupt America from within and without.
The federal government establishes a new agency for overseas covert action.
The Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, the BNDD.
And within it, the forces of Delta Green.
In the Borealis Connection, the new globe-spanning mega-campaign for the fall of Delta Green, you become the mythos-hunting agents hidden inside the BNDD.
Play 8 linked operations.
As separate standalones.
Or linked into an epic hunt for an infamous target.
Escort a sniper carrying a death warrant for a Shan warlord.
Surveil a Saigon drug summit.
Track heroin couriers on a flight from Hong Kong to L.A.
Investigate the disappearance of an archaeologist working the Bozukepi ceremonial site.
Smash a Beirut drug deal.
ID the actors broadcasting the Necronomicon from a CIA backed Munich radio station.
And wage the drug war amid France's May 68 riots.
Designed by Kenneth Haidt.
Written by Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
The team that brought you the Zelazny Quartet and the Dracula dossier.
The Borealis Connection.
Gorgeously designed and horrifically illustrated by Jen McCleary.
A tale of sordid intrigue.
Cosmic horror.
And desperate action against the mythos.
Now available in Titanic hardback.
From specially cleared gaming retail stores.
And the Pelgrane Press web store.
Now also at the web store as an instantly available PDF-only purchase.
It's time once more to undergo a retinal scan and make sure that we're disguised from those CCTV cameras, because we're once more in the Tradecraft Hut. And this time around, beloved Patreon backer Yuri Horniman demands that we use the story of Jan Marsalek as an excuse to talk about Knight's Black Agents. Oh, such a finely crafted question. So the story of Jan Marsalek is told in a long, extended, and it deserves all of its the length it's been given, article in The Insider, which you can look up. And I imagine, as we'll get to later, this is part of a consortium of different press organizations that came together to research him to the back teeth. So you'll probably be able to find versions in German and so forth. But this is quite the story. And in addition to profiling a particular individual, gives you a really great snapshot of information gathering, including the sort that will be available to the player characters in our current age. So, Ken, you've reviewed the dossier of Jan Marsalek. Tell us his story.
I have. All right. He's born in 1980 in Vienna. His father dies when he's 10. He's seems to have mostly been raised by his grandfather, Hans Marsalek, who was, as it happens, a suspected Russian spy. He was a member of the Austrian resistance during the war and may have made contact with the Red Army or the Red Underground at the time and may have kept those contacts up even once Austria became neutral. He was fingered in a 1956 memo as a Russian spy, and he was never prosecuted because he was a resistance hero. So he just continued out his life, and I suppose people kept important government secrets from him, which is how you used to do it back in the day. You'd finger the guy, and then you'd just sort of...
Or did they, since the, the history of tradecraft is also a history of shoddy tradecraft.
Exactly. So anyway, this is the background of this fellow. He's something of a tech prodigy. At 20, he is hired by Wirecard, which is the German payments processing company. So it's like German PayPal that also developed credit cards and a bank. So it's like German Super PayPal. Hired in 2000 and becomes its chief operating officer in 2010, which is a pretty meteoric rise. I assume Wirecard was a plucky startup when he joined it. Wirecard by then has started to attract attention from the Financial Times and others for dubious accounting. Their way of expanding is they would buy a payment processor in some other country, in Dubai or Singapore or wherever, and they would buy it at more than its value. And then they would take that value that they said it was worth and add it to their balance sheet. And people said, well, that was a $9 million company that you just bought for $50 million. And why is this on your balance sheet? And they said, well, because our patented systems make it much more valuable once we own it. And everyone sort of bought that.
Apparently, the term money laundering didn't immediately go into anyone's head. Yeah.
Wirecard, however, was sensitive enough to these sorts of rude questions that it hired the former head of Libyan foreign intelligence, a guy named Rami al-Obaidi, to engage in sting operations against the Financial Times reporters and against short sellers, and simultaneously lobbied its pals, or possibly more than pals, Angela Merkel and Olaf Scholz, who at that time, of course, were running Germany, to get these horrible, horrible lies to stop. So the German financial regulator swings into action in 2019 and threatens to prosecute the Financial Times and short sellers, because how dare you say horrible things about Angela Merkel's good friend Wirecard? Well, as with many things propounded by Angela Merkel, it all blew up. In June 2020, Wirecard announces a shortfall of 1.9 billion euro. Shortfall meaning we can't hide the embezzling anymore. Shortfall meaning we're terrible at our jobs. Who can say? The CEO is arrested. Marszalek says, well, I'm flying to the Philippines to clear myself, but...
Yeah, and I'm just going to say, if the evidence that clears you is in the Philippines...
Yeah.
Maybe it's not going to clear you.
Yeah. Well, we'll never know, Robin, because he never got to the Philippines. He went to Minsk instead. And from Minsk, he went into hiding in Moscow. And an Interpol red notice was issued for him in August 2020. And the Russian government says, well, we can't find this guy. We don't know where he is. He could be anywhere. It's a big city. We're just a simple, peaceful, non-surveillance state.
Yes, we don't know anything about money launderers here.
Hiding it. That's crazy talk.
Yeah.
But he's more than a money launderer. According to various accusations made by Western governments, he is a Russian asset. He approached the GRU, they believe sometime around 2011, GRU, Russian Military Intelligence, through the Austrian-Russian Friendship Society, which sounds like a bunch of thin cover guys, if I've ever heard of it.
Yes. And for those not taking notes, this is 1 year into his becoming COO.
Right. In 2014, he meets with a GRU handler in Marseille. They arrange financing for Wagner Group operations in Libya and elsewhere. This is episode 504, if you want to know more about Wagner. By 2017, he is traveling to Palmyra and elsewhere in Syria at the behest and as the guest of Russian military intelligence. So he's not keeping a low profile. Like, he literally hired a company to fly him in a MiG to Moscow while he's still at Wirecard.
Yes. The name is Marszalek.
Jan Marszalek.
It's like that level of James Bond. Everybody knows this guy. He's a famous spy going around doing famous spy things.
Or they should have. Anyhow, once he gets to Moscow in 2020, not on the plane, but on a different, nicer plane, he spends some time in FSB training. The GRU passes him off to the FSB. He learns Russian. He gets plastic surgery, hair replacement, grows a beard to change his appearance. And now he has apparently six different fake identities, including a Belgian passport, which is a nice touch, and two different Russian priests plus a bunch of other Russian IDs.
Right. And it wasn't clear to me from the article, the implication was that these were actual Russian priests that he was impersonating, but it wasn't 100% clear.
Well, I mean, it's one of those things where they might have been actual Russian priests and then their ID became open and available, or it might be that the Russian Orthodox Church in Russia has been operating as a glove on the hand of the intelligence services for so long that it's just standard that, you know, a priest is going to go into a monastery or whatever, and then he leaves his papers out for the KGB to use, or now the FSB. So, right.
And you need them because of vampires, but we'll get to that.
So, you know, doesn't let grass grow under his feet. In 2020, as he's, you know, coming out of his FSB training school, he starts acting as the paymaster and handler for a 5-man FSB spy ring in the UK. This is headed by a Bulgarian guy named Orlin Rusov, and it's aimed at other things, at the former Bellingcat journalist Christo Grozev, who is on the Jan Marszalek beat with The Insider and Der Spiegel. And Bellingcat, of course, is from episode 582. They're the quote-unquote freelance intelligence newsletter and are probably, at the very least, you know, they get to eat in the MI6 cafeteria, is I guess what I'll say about that.
Right. And there's a theme in the Insider piece of, guess what, Russian asset and Russian spies, look at how we've got all of this information on you and how well we did it.
So yes, it's very stunty.
A delightful undertone of snapping back.
Mm-hmm. So Rusev runs 6 networks in Europe, which is very impressive. So Marszalek is the grand boss of Rusev, who is the guy on the ground, because Marszalek obviously can't go to London. Rusev runs these 6 networks in Europe, including a 2022 spy ring that surveilled a U.S. base in Stuttgart. Rusev and his UK team are arrested in 2023 by a series of simultaneous raids, one assumes by the special branch or whoever has taken over their job, MO13 or whoever it is. In 2021, therefore, we move back in time. The woman who taught him Russian was a lady named Tatiana Spiridonova, and she was married at the time, but they begin a beautiful romance, Robin, and it's a coincidence that she is a FSB, let us say asset, let us not say agent, that would be mean, but probably.
Right. She belongs to the Imperial Orthodox Palestine Society, which a lot of FSB people, including its head, belong to and is a long time.
And by the way, a much cooler thing to belong to than the Austrian-Russian Friendship Society. I will say that just right off the top.
Well, the word imperial in it, right? That right. has that czarist ring to it.
Exactly.
And anyway, she was stationed at a Russian embassy in Pakistan. And the two of them were probably introduced by Marszalek's recruiter, Stanislav Petlinski. And she winds up working for him as a courier. You're going to get into the ferrying around of laptops and phones and stuff. And she was often the one taking them around because, you know, women attract less scrutiny even today.
And he may have self-recruited. Second of all, he met a different GRU guy before Petlinski. He met Petlinski in 2014 in Marseille. But if he's been operating as a spy since 2011, he would have had a different handler and a different recruiter. But either way, Petlinski is his guy now. So, among the things that Spiridonova and Marszalek do is in 2022, they set up a operation that purchases 3 smartphones belonging to higher-ups in the Austrian Interior Ministry, and then they buy those, send her down to Istanbul to make the handover. She can travel to Turkey because of the Imperial Orthodox Palestine Society credentials. And I love the notion, that, by the way, this society, which I admit I did not research itself, but it sounds very much like one of the societies that was set up in the 1870s, or perhaps even earlier, to defend the interests of the Orthodox Church against the Ottoman Turks in Palestine and in the Balkans. And so, therefore, it would have been an old Okhrana front. And that's what makes me delighted about this. So, anyway, the other thing that she does in 2022 is courier down to Istanbul to buy a laptop with a NATO-compliant SINA encryption system on it. So that's, you know, whatever's going on, Marszalek is keeping his tech hand in.
Right, that's your MacGuffin right there,
right.
Game Masters.
Since 2023, he has been a frequent visitor to the Crimea. He has also visited Mariupol during the war, which is now occupied by the Russians. And he's sometimes accompanied by Spetsnaz troopers. There is a sort of a speculation. Is he actually on the front lines fighting? This seems like a waste of a tech guy and money launderer, but we don't know.
Well, they are running out of guys.
Yeah, they are. I feel like he would not take the $40,000 signing bonus to join the military. I just feel like he has a better sense of what money is worth at this point. Although he has spent something like $200,000 stalking Christo Grozev and the investigatorial team at the Insider, Der Spiegel, ZDF, and the Austrian Der Standard, who are all
right
cooperating on this.
And sometimes you take an assignment you don't want to just to prove that you've done it and then get right out of there as soon as you can.
So the investigative team basically seems like the big thing that they did is bribe the Russian telecoms company to sell them all the cell phone data for Moscow for a given period of time. And then they just comb through it looking for this guy's cell phone. And once they find that, they find out who he calls. It's just like hunting Al-Qaeda back in the war in Iraq. They find out who he calls, find out who those people are. Oh, look, it's good old Tatiana. I wonder who she calls. I wonder how often his cell phone pings at the Lubyanka, you know, subway station. That's a lot of times. And as they start going through, they sort of make the snarky point that Russia is so corrupt that all of its records can be bought by Westerners with hard currency, which makes it, ironically, one of the most transparent societies in the world.
Yes. And they don't just get phone records. They've got CCTV caps. They've got Spiridonova's biometric passport application. Mm-hmm. And so the lesson for Knight's Black Agents is that your characters, if they have, you know, enough cash on them and know who to talk to, can get an amazing amount of information on the Russian government and presumably its satellite states and possibly any other state that's just as corrupt, that there's a tendency to think, oh, it's not realistic at all to think that I'd be able to get all this information. They have a great airtight security. No, they do not. You can buy what you need.
Because they're horribly corrupt. And they've even got his traffic tickets. He was given a ticket for riding a scooter too fast in Moscow. And this is maybe why he's going to Crimea, is because he got his ticket late in his stay in Moscow. And previously he was apparently boasting that he had a little card that the FSB gave him that would let him, you know, get out of traffic stops free. And if, you know, you have that card and you're given a ticket anyway, that's just Putin's little way of encouraging you to do better, I feel.
Right. Or, you know, summon low on the totem pole or whatever. But or maybe there's a rule, you know, you don't have to go to the front until you ride your scooter on the sidewalk.
Until it's speeding tickets means mandatory time in Mariupol. That's the new rule.
Yes. There's another great lesson in this article that reminds us of something that we already know from the Tradecraft, which is that spies just can't shut up. Yeah. So, for example, they contact Petlinsky and they talk to him about Marsalek. And instead of saying, I don't know who you're talking about, I better hang up the phone. I shouldn't be talking to Der Spiegel about my FSB
about
guy.
My asset.
He gives him a somewhat extensive description of the guy.
A sit-down interview in Dubai, in fact.
So he says, he's super precise, a bit autistic, and lacking in empathy. It's like, thanks, buddy.
Yeah,
I share all those missions for you. Now you slam me like this just to wave your gums to a reporter at a sit-down reporting. He does deny being his recruiter, which you say technically he may not be.
Yeah.
Just his dear friend. But it's like, dear friend?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know how dear friends talk about each other, Robin. You and I have described each other as super precise and lacking in empathy 1,000 times, I feel.
And they, of course, they call Marsalek. And does Marsalek, the first time they call him, they ask if it's him. And he goes, who are you talking? You've made a mistake. And he hangs up the second time. He can't resist continuing on because these guys all got to brag, right? And so they wind up asking why he's been stalking Grozev and another journalist. And instead of just hanging up, he goes, those are very interesting names. And like he's playing Sidney Greenstreet on the phone with them. And so, again, the lesson for Knight's Black Agents is even the people who are supposed to be these operatives who can't possibly break security to say anything dumb to you and essentially confirm everything you've just asked them, they will. They can't not brag about being spies.
And if you're dealing with a mid-level figure in the conspiracy, why not ask him to meet you in Dubai? What's the worst that could happen? You know, he shows up, he drops some personality dish on one of the vampires, and then you decide, well, that was fun, but now do we exploit this contact? Do we try and kill him in Dubai? What do we do? And that depth of strategic option, as well as the depth of sort of, you know, tone, is, I think, part of what makes espionage so fascinating anyway, but also I think what can make your NBA game more than simply stalk, stalk, stalk. You can add all kinds of quality to it over and above, you know, oh, right. The vampires have $1.9 billion that Angela Merkel let them have. That's a fun reveal, but what are they doing with it? Well, they're hiring a bunch of Bulgarians. That's bad. But also, they're getting a hot girlfriend. They're riding a scooter. They're having a great time.
Yeah, I forget whether NBA has Flattery or not, but it turns out
Flattery is a flirting, in fact.
Yeah. It has flirting,
yep.
But whatever the equivalent closest thing to Flattery is, you just, you know, butter the person up a bit, and pretty soon it'll be, yeah, I think my guy's a vampire. Yeah. I didn't suspect it at first, but there's this stench of death, but... you know, I carry this cross, and wouldn't it be cool if I really was working for a vampire? So you can justify a lot of necessary information getting to the player interface.
I work in the Lubyanka. The stench of death has been there for a while. It is in the damn walls. But I did note that it also is true at a Starbucks with him. So you can say.
And also he's got his little rat friend who speaks in Russian, which initially was disturbing, and now I've gotten used to.
And when he got his Imperial Orthodox Palestine Society card, he says, finally, I can replace the one I lost under Nicholas. And I don't even know what he was talking about with that.
So the broader point that I derive from all of this is that at least in Russia, and I assume Belarus and its other satellites, is that we talk about the cowboy era of espionage being long over, but it's not over there. And you can free will your way to a lot of information and contacts that you arguably shouldn't be able to do if you're trying to be realistic instead of actual.
Well, I mean, a lot of the, you know, era of cowboys is over is the CIA self-justifying being garbage at human. If you're a British spy or a Bellingcat journalist, he said, a distinction perhaps without a difference, then yeah, human is key. Human is always key because, as you point out, as we all know, as you can tell by reading one biography, spies are broken, flawed people, and therefore, in many cases, are actually easier to get around than like a hardware store manager would be.
Right. And therefore, people you can talk to get information to make your story go.
Exactly.
Speaking of stories, it's time for us to consider some stories of another sort after we experience the narrative of this beautiful commercial message. In the spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Protect this podcast from knife-wielding dungeons, alongside such beloved Patreon backers as...
George Poles.
Mike Merles.
Oli Toivonen.
Peter Williamson.
And Chris McLaren.
Once more, the smell of popcorn, the whir of the projector, and the invitation to the comfy recliners in the center seats in the center aisle of the cinema hut call us to sit down and resume our Fantasy Film Essentials Film Festival. And today, I believe, Robin, we are going to get all the way through the year 1991, which seems like quite a year for fantasy. We're all very proud of 1988, but now 1991 is coming up.
It's an incredible banner year, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have it noted down here as being early 90s fantasy films, but you're right. It's 1991 fantasy films.
Right. So let's start then with the other argument for best Disney film of the era, which is, of course, Beauty and the Beast, directed by Gary Troutsell and Kirk Wise, and starring Paige O'Hara as Belle, Robbie Benson as the Beast, and everyone's like, yeah, get to Angela Lansbury. Angela Lansbury as Mrs. Potts, the talking teapot. Does she make the entire movie? Well, even Divine Angela can't make an entire movie, but she absolutely is part and parcel of that great Disney tradition where you take people whose voices you've loved your entire life, and then you make them a fun side character that gets to sort of advance the plot Greek chorus style by telling you what you already know. The songs, again, are Ashman and Macon. They're phenomenal. It's a big, beautiful movie. It's, again, a movie about an outsider who becomes an insider. So it's figured out a really good psychological way to do the old fairy tale, which is poor becomes rich. And now that we're all basically, rich as lords in medieval times, we have to figure out another aspiration. And this aspiration is, I want to belong. And Beauty and the Beast is a magnificent movie about belonging. It finds the core of that fairy tale there. And it's great. The only thing I would say about it is that it is not quite as magnificent sort of, you know, spectacle to me as The Little Mermaid was. And that may just be tropical versus mahogany, tropical versus medieval. I don't know. But I really, really, you know, you can't not like Beauty and the Beast. I would say that.
Right. It represents an advance in a number of ways. One of which is that where Little Mermaid is still a Disney movie with a lot of songs, this is like a flat out Broadway musical staged as an animated film. And in fact, winds up as an easy port into a theatrical production later on. This is also the one where CGI backgrounds are becoming more of the element. So more of the images of the ballroom, for example, are what are adding to the visual appeal of this. So the look is beginning to mutate from cell animation into a more contemporary style of animation. And I also have to mention the voice performance of Jerry Orbach as Lumiere the Candlestick, because it's just such a sweet thing that Lenny Briscoe of Law and Order, who of course also had a very long Broadway career as a singer and performer, he's drawing more on his role in The Fantastics than on Law and Order, is also part of this. So
as much as we would love to see Lumiere beat a confession out of a suspect, it just doesn't happen in the original.
No, it does not. Speaking of trials, the trial part, that brings us to Defending Your Life from 1991 by Albert Brooks. One of the great things about the fantasy series is that even more so than horror and science fiction, there is a tradition of great directors doing one fantasy movie, and it enables us to talk about them. So Albert Brooks gets on the list with this afterlife fantasy. So it's sort of a spoofy version of A Matter of Life and Death. He plays a sort of a self-absorbed, uptight dweeb who, through sheer negligence, winds up dying in a car crash and winds up in this very anodyne version of the afterlife, which has it was almost like The Office before The Office. And there's I love the bit where they're all sort of wheeled in wheelchairs looking kind of stunned because they've just died. Rip Torn is the attorney who's going to defend his life, and he says essentially, don't think of it as a trial, but yes, it is. And there's a great love story with Meryl Streep as another recently deceased person going through the processing, and of course she's Meryl Streep, so she's struggling less than the Albert Brooks character. So it's, in a way, Albert Brooks' movie about death is his most hopeful, happy, joyous movie, but also extremely funny and well worth seeing, whether you're compiling a list of fantasy essentials or a list of comedy essentials.
Yeah, it's a great movie. It's a feel-good time. And I think, as you say, this is part of that glorious tradition of weirdly bureaucratized heaven movies that we started getting in the 30s and 40s, and we're still getting it every now and again now, and we still have that notion that somehow the afterlife has to follow rules, and there's a form you fill out, and everything is going to be straightened out if you can just get to the right guy. This wildly self-defeating view of heaven does at least make for great comedy. Theologically, I think it's unsound, but it is also such a, you know, I mean, we've talked about it. I mean, I think that was all we were talking about through the 40s was either you were a ghost on the earth or you were a ghost on trial in some fashion. And it was just a constant part of early Hollywood fantasy. And that, and to see it continue into the 90s is a nice touch. And the part of fantasy that harkens back to older stories, I think really sort of resonates when you do an old 40s chestnut and you do it as well and as freshly as Albert Brooks did.
Speaking of directors making one fantasy film and getting on our list, Krzysztof Kieślowski, the Polish cinema master, in 1991 makes The Double Life of Veronique. And this is essentially a piece of magic realism. It's very poetic. The plot of the film is not what it's about at all. It's an experiential movie about feelings and evanescent moments, but it's about having a doppelganger. Irene Jacob plays two roles. One of them is Weronika in Poland. She's a Polish choir singer, and Veronique, who lives in France and is a music teacher. And at the beginning, this is not a spoiler, Veronika dies of a heart attack, and Veronique feels this sense of sudden loss, which sort of reverberates through her life. It affects her relationship with her boyfriend. She winds up taking up with a children's author and puppeteer who has a metaphor waiting for her later in the film. But it's also the most hopeful film by Krzysztof Kieślowski, who during the Iron Curtain years in Poland made some devastatingly despairing or wrenching movies. But this is sort of his film of pure beauty, celebrating the mystery and strangeness of life through this sort of doppelganger metaphor. And it's recently had a 4K restoration, if you want to find that.
Speaking of movies that harken back, we're now going to turn our attention to Ron Clements and John Musker's Aladdin, also from 1991. Disney not understanding the concept of spacing them out a little bit. But this, of course, the very earliest fantasy films that we talked about included Thief of Baghdad over and over again. And here we are basically back on the same streets of Baghdad, the same stories. And now it's a fun Disney animated cartoon. Scott Wanger is the voice of Aladdin, Linda Larkin, the great Linda Larkin, as Princess Jasmine, and obviously, and perhaps overbearingly, Robin Williams as the genie. And this is almost better as a Robin Williams showcase than it is as an Aladdin movie, but it does manage to hit all the beats, do all the wonderful things that, you know, Thief of Baghdad and the old Aladdin movies did, and do it to, again, terrific songs and bigger-than-life visuals. It's another example of a Disney sort of, you know, taking that we have to exoticize if we're exoticizing stuff job seriously and putting together a very visually striking film. Again, if I'm ranking them, this is below Beauty and the Beast for me and certainly below Little Mermaid, but you can't deny that it's a triumph. It is funny as heck, and it is resolutely in the tradition both of Disney and of fantasy film going back to the 1920s.
Speaking of another film with a shapeshifter, this time not a genie, Orlando, directed by Sally Potter. This is based on the Virginia Woolf novel, and it's about a very, very handsome young noble with even as a man, he looks a bit like a woman, and you get that in the film because his character is played by Tilda Swinton, herself a magical creature. So Orlando is first seen in Elizabethan times. Elizabeth, played by Quentin Crisp, the pioneer of queer culture, commands Orlando never to wither or grow old. He's too beautiful. Instead, if he agrees not to age, she will give him a tract of land and a castle. And he obliges by becoming immortal. And partway through his immortal life in 1750, when he returns from an embassy to the Ottomans, he one day wakes up and is transformed into a woman. This is a visually beautiful film, a spiritually beautiful film. It is the movie that brought Tilda Swinton to everyone's attention. and as I mentioned before, sort of a foundational text of queer cinema, and it's absolutely a delight to get to mention it in the context of our Fantasy Film Essentials.
Yeah, when I saw it, I think I was madder that it didn't include more of Orlando Furioso. I hadn't read the Wolf novel at the time, but it was certainly a lovely thing to watch, and Tilda Swinton is a treasure, and this is, as you say, sort of her breakout performance. I was just, you know, I felt that there should have been more Italian epics that it was not even a movie about, which was on me, not on Sally Potter or even on Virginia Woolf.
Well, on that note, it's time for us to head on out of the cinema. We'll have another 5 films to talk about next week, but we're not out of topics because we have a final segment waiting for us on the other side of this. The British are coming! The British are coming!
In Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The new campaign guide, The American Crisis, War in the North, covers the early actions of the war with historical adventures, setting information, and a fiendish Hessian plot.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
Educators can get a copy of the core book for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The American Crisis is now fully available in print as well as PDF.
Visit nationsandcannons.com to check out a free adventure chapter and the quick start guide.
It's time once more to enter a part of the show that frankly doesn't deserve a full hut. It just gets a corner. And that's because it's sort of the central theme of our days these days in a way that it wasn't when we started. It's the fever swamp that increasingly gets out and infects the regular news. And this is an example of that, Ken, because this is the conspiracy corner. And we're going to provide you, the listener, with the background to when you hear people talking about med beds, you will then be able to explain where that latest bit of craziness to bubble up from the swamp comes from originally.
Right. Well, the med bed comes from Nikola Tesla, who invented it, or the aliens who invented it. And I think we can all agree on that. There are 3 types of med beds. The holographic med bed detects and heals all your illnesses. The regenerative med bed, that will regrow tissue, including limbs, whole limbs, and regression or rejuvenation bed, which will reverse aging. So that would be great. That's great.
Right. And so to back up a step, in case people don't know what the heck we're talking about, this is a conspiracy theory that essentially says that modern day people in our current world have Star Trek style sick bays and are keeping them from the ordinary people.
Right. Yes, they are currently either the exclusive property of the usual committee of rich bastards or of the U.S. military, which keeps them at Area 51 because they're alien, and they loan them out to billionaires if the military needs a favor from a billionaire, or the military will roll them out to everyone once Nisara is enacted and the financial structure of the country upends itself. And Nisara, we covered that conspiracy in that theory in episode 445. Or, and this is, I think, the funnest of the theories, even if it is the stupidest, and believe me, this is saying something of them, that a global omni-military conspiracy like in Independence Day has been established and has med beds and will eventually do a coup against civilian governments so that it can roll them out for everyone. Why the omni-military conspiracy exists in the first place? Why it's distracting itself with wars amongst its members?
Yes. Why it would need a coup in order to introduce this benevolent technology?
I don't get any of it, but that is how you can tell that the seeds of this particular version of the medbed tech were sown in the era of QAnon, when the whole notion was that some brave general or other figure would lead a coup against the conspiracy of reptiles or pedophiles or whoever they were that were making everything bad. And right around 2018 is when JFK Jr. survived his plane crash, became part of Q lore. And then around 2020, of course, medical paranoia on all sides spikes like crazy. And so the sort of notion of how did JFK Jr. survive? How did JFK Sr. survive? The answer is med beds. Med beds did it. That's where they are. They're kept in med beds. And this sort of got spread out of Q containment once Q sort of broke down around 2020. So you have American weirdo influencers starting to go on, you know, YouTube and other channels talking about it, podcasts. The Queen of Canada, Romana Didulo, who I don't know if we've discussed, but she's all about the med beds as well.
Yeah, I think we have discussed her.
All right. The notion of the med bed is that it retunes. And this is as simple. I mean, if once you see how it works, Robin, you're just going to say, well, of course, they retune your ion's biofrequency using biophotons. But this is the, I know what you're going to say. Can biophotons, we've had those since the 60s, biophotons in the terahertz range, Robin. And that's the important thing. And I feel like now that we know that, we know how the med beds work. And in fact, we already have companies, which someone in the notes to this has described as scam companies, and that someone was me, will either charge you for your med bed card so that you can go access the secret military med beds now, or they have phony med beds set up already. One company named Tesla Biohealing, no connection to the car, run by a guy named Dr. James Liu, who has a panoply of complaints against him from Better Business Bureau, FTC, AMA, former patients. This guy is a piece of work. He operates, among other places, out of a former motel in East Dubuque, and you sleep on the med bed, and there are med bed canisters there, which have your biophotons. But someone, some hater, Robin, opened up one of the canisters, and it was just full of cement. So I don't know if the biophotons turn into cement if you expose them to air. I'm not sure.
If you expose them to skepticism, that's when they turn to cement.
Skepticism. That's what does it. And there's a Canadian company named Orgo Life that has a med bed that it will rent you or, for a much bigger amount of money, sell you. It's like $20,000 for the special cancer-curing med bed. So these people are basically the worst people in the universe. But there is a compromise between those two versions of the scam. Medbedcards.com will sell you cards, which also give you access to the website where they go on in tiresome detail. But also, if you get three cards, so you and your wife and your dog or whatever, then you get a free Ionicare device. So they're really looking out for you. But I feel like the best of all of them is a Swiss company called 9010, which says you don't have to come to Switzerland. You just lie in your bed and we will teleport or beam quantum energy into your body using our patented faster-than-light technology. So your bed can be a med bed. And for legal purposes, this is a meditation bed, because calling it a medical bed would be a scam of some kind. And we would have no truck with such a scam. We are a legitimate faster-than-light quantum beaming company based in Switzerland. How dare you? How very dare you?
So this whole nexus of conspiratorial ideation is basically pulled in magnetically different themes and images, basically from the history of alliptony from at least the 19th century onward. So, of course, fake cures has been a fraud even before there were reliable real cures.
Right, yeah.
And this is basically just taking that eternal promise of help for vulnerable sick people, or just, you know, people who want to live longer, I guess, like Orlando, and turning it into money by defrauding people. That's as obvious and simple a reason to exploit or promote a conspiracy theory as any. But again, this also has all of these science fiction elements, and it appeals to different people who are already demonstrated a vulnerability to this style of thought by, it's like, well, if you're a Tesla guy and an alternative energy person and you believe all that stream of conspiracy theories, that you've got an entryway into med beds. If you're a UFO person, that's your way into med beds. So let's mention Area 51.
If you're a Kennedy conspiracy person, well, the med beds are keeping Kennedy alive. And isn't that great news?
Right. And this went into the cauldron of QAnon, which is also an attention economy. So people at sudden super speed, no longer communicating by weird mimeograph zines that they mail to each other, but at the speed of a forum, are developing and shaping the conspiracies for greater appeal. And the ones that people don't comment on get downvoted. The ones that people like did. So this is where you get the whole still inexplicable JFK Jr. part of this whole thing. I guess,
right. Yeah.
You know, the Kennedys have always been part of a conspiracy theory since the assassination of President Kennedy, but That was such a weird junior element to add into it. And of course, there's a whole other thread where there's a dude who looks nothing at all like JFK Jr. and isn't even in the same age band as pretending to be him. But in our hyper-accelerated conspiracy environment, of course, it's harder and harder to get a grip on these things, especially since their audience is a group of people who do not want to be debunked and arguably are incapable of being debunked.
Yes. And perhaps as a cherry on this Sunday of idiocy, President Trump posted an AI-generated fake Fox News segment, the Lara Trump-hosted Fox News segment. They faked that up. I mean, she really is a host. That's a real thing. But the segment was fake. And it was about medbeds and how medbeds are being rolled out and Trump is going to fix everything and the medbeds are going to be a thing. He posted this up on September 27th to his Truth Social account and then deleted it the same day. And when asked about this bizarre performance, White House spokesperson Caroline Leavitt said, "The president loves to post memes and videos that he sees and enjoys." And, you know, of things said by any White House spokesperson, that is undeniably true.
That is as close as they've gotten to, oh, Gramps.
Yep. The president loves to post memes.
I am loath to attempt to attribute any specific thought to the president of the United States of America, but my presumption here is that he looked at it and went, "That's me. I like me. Send." But who knows?
It's just a time of magic and wonder that we live in. And sadly, though, a time of magic and wonder that does not include alien Tesla beds that will refocus our ions biofrequency. We have to do that the old fashioned way, Robin, by drinking.
Right. So in real life, we, of course, must mock and debunk this utter nonsense. And as you pointed out, shameful nonsense in the case of people who are
exploiting cancer victims.
But then we can turn it into fiction and make more fun of it, but also have more fun with it by making it part of a game. And so this seems fake med beds seems like an esoteric thing. Real med beds that turn you into a Carcosin seems like a yellow king. This is normal thing. But I think it would be easy enough for all matter of sinister forces to gather an army of willing accomplices and also just hoover up some money and, you know, who knows, souls by drawing in people with the promise of med beds and who knows.
And if it's a nice Black Agents conspiracy and, you know, you go to Switzerland or Romania or wherever to sleep in the real med bed, not the phony med bed, you wake up, you feel great.
Yeah.
Because guess what? Someone put vampire blood in you and now you're a Renfield. So you do feel strong and good. And maybe, in fact, even your cancer did go into remission because the vampire blood is fighting it and turning you into a Renfield and not a human. And then the med beds work.
Isn't this med bed a coffin? No. We call it a native soil receptacle. Get on in.
It's going to retune your biofrequency. The native soil biophotons are the best. And that, you know, having an obvious conspiracy. I mean, any player worth their salt shown a med bed. Well, I say this, but 20% will statistically want to lie down in the med bed.
There's one person in every group who's going to have their character get in the med bed.
But most players will know that it's a scam. But then when they see people up walking around saying, "I feel great. I went to Romania for the med beds," then if you're proper NBA players, you say, aha, a no to the conspiracy. If you are the sort of people being drawn in for the first time, maybe you investigate it. Maybe you have a solace that you want to take care of. And that is how you discover, oh, vampires. But either way, it is an inescapable bit of our Macedoine of nonsense in the modern era, which means games using them have all kind of possibilities. I do like the idea of lying down in a med bed and your biophotons in the terahertz range are yellow and they're beamed to you from Carcosa, not from Switzerland. And I think that's cool too, that the med bed becomes sort of the old incubatio of the pagans where you lie in it and you dream of a god and the god solves your problem, heals you. But obviously gods want favors. And so that might be Casilda or Camilla wanting a favor, Hastur wanting a favor, or it might be, you know, some other transdimensional monstrosity who, yeah, sure, I don't care what your cells look like. I'll change them. But in the meantime, if you could blow up that standing stone, that would be a real help to me.
And it could be a smokescreen even in a horror conspiracy world, right? There aren't really med beds, but there's older methods of bringing people back from the dead. And maybe when you do that, they look a little less like they did when they were first walking the earth.
That's right.
So it can be sort of your explanation, except particularly for credulous people, of, you know, why Elvis is a background or Tupac or whoever. It's like, oh, well, they were, you know, they had to spend a long time in the med bed, but, you know, now they're out and now they're back operating around. And,
right.
And in any of these universes, that could be true, or it could be a cover story for a more sort of old fashioned ritualistic way of bringing people back from right. the dead, or creating homunculi who look right. vaguely like past deceased celebrities.
What do biophotons do to your essential salts? Tune in for $29.99 and find out today.
Right. Well, we better get our web store up with the Essential Salts deal. So it's time for us to head off for another week. But never fear, we'll be back a mere week from today with more of this. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Prevent the financial collapse of this podcast by joining such backers as
Darren Dumay,
Lee Candelino,
Luke Steyer,
Chris McCarthy,
and Steen Comer.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindelaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.